assumption.
Oh, yeah. Well, not that John mentioned. Apparently he was uncertain. Perhaps he'll turn up for the dinner.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. We'll use that. I don't mind. I don't mind how unsubtle it is.
Now, Lynn, I've been given a little bit of blurb about you, which John's pulled off. I suppose we're ready to go. Okay, it's past 1:30, so we might as well resume. We're looking in this session at state innovations in bicameralism. It occurred to me this morning when we were getting our potted history lessons about the Senate and its origins, that, you know, story about bits taken from Washington and Westminster, that there's a third part of this story that my colleague Campbell Sharman's written about in the past and that should be essential reading for everybody who wants to talk about the antecedents of the Senate, and that is that that all Australian jurisdictions prior to the creation of the Commonwealth had bicameral parliaments. And even if Australia hadn't been a federation, it would have looked highly anomalous for the Commonwealth Parliament to be set up in unicameral form. So one of the major reasons why the Parliament of the Commonwealth is bicameral is that it is part of an Australian tradition of bicameralism that reaches back into colonial times, back into the 19th century. That's where I'll start with my talk in a minute. But before I get on to my talk, let me just briefly introduce my two colleagues here to my right. I'm chairing and talking, which hopefully is not as difficult as sort of eating and talking and other sorts of chewing gum and thinking. I'll talk for maybe 15, 20 minutes, whatever. I'll get the signal at some point and stop. And I'll be followed by Lynn Lovelock, who's the clerk of the New South Wales Legislative Council. Lynn was appointed to this position and to the position of Clerk of Parliaments on the 29th of July 2007. This followed a period when she was acting clerk of the Legislative Council. And the website I'm looking at in front of me tells me that she has a wealth of knowledge and experience in the management of the Parliament and in parliamentary practice and procedure and a background in research and in the development of public policy. And I'm sure every syllable of that is true. The third of our speakers will be Brian Costa, Professor Brian Costa from Swinburne University. I'm looking for my other piece of paper. Brian is Professor of Victorian Parliamentary Democracy at Swinburne University. I've got a great list of his principal research areas. Suffice it to say that he works on a broad range of topics in Australian politics to do with institutions and institutional processes. I won't read the long list. Obviously, among his interests are parliaments and the Victorian Parliament, about which we'll hear some more. I've also got a list of his books, and again, it would take me a while to read them out, but again, suffice it to say that Brian is author and editor of a number of books, a number of articles, and is a frequent commentator on Australian politics in the media. Okay, Brian, I'm told, will talk about matters of procedure. He's going to talk about the committee system in the Victorian Parliament, and Lynn, as befits her role as clerk, will talk about procedural matters mainly. I think actually there's something about the electoral system there that'll be interesting. I had a section of my remarks that related to procedure. I've cut that out and put it to one side, so I won't address procedural issues, but maybe I'll try and bring the discussion back if there's time later on to some of the procedural matters that I'm interested in if we have time. What I want to talk about is the institutional design of Australian state upper houses, say something about the evolution, innovations in the institutions of state bicameralism, and then say something about several issues that I think are raised by innovations in state bicameralism. So let's commence. Over the long term, innovations in bicameralism in the Australian states have, I think, in many ways followed those in the Commonwealth Parliament. But their starting point in the states was very different to that at Commonwealth level. The Senate, as we heard earlier, was conceived as a democratic institution. By comparison, the legislative councils in the states were originally designed as powerful conservative restraints on colonial lower houses, based for their times on very broad franchises. Those legislative councils which were elected, and that is all bar New South Wales and Queensland, those legislative councils which were elected were characterised by restricted franchises and special qualifications for members amongst a range of mechanisms for over-representing the wealthy. In these houses, furthermore, terms of office were fixed and much longer than for lower houses. There were also elaborate rotations of members, and election cycles were independent of those in lower houses. While the undemocratic features of state upper houses were gradually eroded during the 20th century, the original model remained salient at the midpoint of the century. But continuing change in a number of areas saw these institutions, the state upper houses, transformed over the second 50 years of the 20th century. First, they were progressively democratised through the acquisition of universal suffrage and compulsory voting to match the adoption of compulsory voting for lower houses, and they also adopted, over time, equally apportioned electoral districts. So they were progressively democratised. Secondly, their terms of election were shortened, and rotations were also shortened or, in one case, eliminated. Thirdly, in the mainland states, conjoint upper and lower house elections were introduced, that is, elections of upper and lower houses on the same date. Fourthly, the New South Wales Legislative Council, the remaining upper house filled by appointment, was given a basis of direct, finally given a basis of direct election. It had been given a basis of indirect election, election by the Parliament in 1933, I think it was. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, proportional representation was introduced first in South Australia in 1973, then in New South Wales in 1978, and in Western Australia in 1987. Haven't forgotten Victoria. I'm coming there in a minute. So I wrote about all of this change in an article published in 2002, and I said in that article, towards the end of that article, by the year 2000, it was possible to identify three types of upper house, state upper house around Australia. The first type had only one exemplar, the Tasmanian Legislative Council. The Tasmanian Legislative Council continued to embody the old ideal of a non-party chamber and had maintained the elaborate rotation of members and the independent electoral cycle which helped it to sustain this ancient ideal. So Tasmania was unique and interesting. The second category contained Western Australia, South Australia, and New South Wales. The legislative councils in these states conformed to a second type, the model for which was the Australian Senate, following its adoption of proportional representation in 1948. These councils had undergone, by the year 2000, the most change since the mid-20th century, in particular a radical change of voting method. They were exemplars of the developing Australian mainland norm that parliamentary systems should comprise a house of government whose electoral system over-represents major parties and frequently manufactures partisan majorities, and a house of review whose electoral system ensures more diverse representation and the incongruent composition, different partisan makeup in the two houses, which underpins autonomy and a sustained capacity to exert influence. So these three, WA, South Australia and New South Wales, had evolved the most over the second half of the 20th century, and so as a result of this evolution, put them together with the Senate, there's this developing mainland norm that there should be a sort of house of government, lower house, which over-represents major parties or the winning party, and an upper house which in which no major party has a majority, at least most of the time. The third category comprised the Victorian Legislative Council. This represented a third type, I argue, due to its continued use of the alternative vote in single-member districts. This electoral system underpinned a bicameral legislature in which governing party dominance of the upper house alternated with opposition dominance. And this had proved a very unsatisfactory model in modern circumstances because it tended to produce either a redundant rubber stamp upper house or what might be termed a hostage upper house harnessed to opposition strategies, for winning a lower house majority. And there are plenty of examples of that in Victoria. The Victorian Chamber at this time looked like its WA and South Australian counterparts prior to their adoption of proportional representation and seemed overripe for such conforming electoral change. So this was the picture at the time I did that research around the turn of the century. The article was published in 2002. What's changed since then? Well, a bit has changed, but I'd argue that it's at least plausible to argue that those three clusters still apply. Tasmanian situation remains much as it was, WA, South Australia and New South Wales. The question is Victoria. Has Victoria joined the second group, or does it still stand alone? The major change in Victoria was for the upper house had several components. First was the introduction of proportional representation in 8 5 member districts. Second was the removal of rotation, so that the upper house had a 4-year term. So it followed WA in that regard, but unlike WA, but like the unreformed Legislative Council in Victoria, the term of the upper house wasn't fixed, but was tied to the term, or remained tied to the term of the lower house. Thirdly, powers over financial legislation were reduced on the New South Wales model. Fourthly, and very importantly, there were new rules introduced, new constitutional rules for the resolution of deadlocks between the houses. And these, I'd argue, seem to weaken significantly the role of the upper house in the legislative process. These rules put together amount, I'd argue, to a distinctive design. So I'd argue that I wouldn't put Victoria in the same box as the other ones, South Australia, WA, New South Wales, and the Senate. So I'd argue these rules have produced the most subordinate model, I'm talking about models here, of an upper house we have seen in Australia. And this has not gone unnoticed. The model has already seemingly influenced the thinking of federal governments looking for ways of weakening the Senate. Howard's proposals of 2003-04 reproduced the new Victorian approach to deadlocks as one of two options for change. More recently, as we know, John Faulkner has voiced support for 4-year Senate terms with no rotation of members, and apparently, I'm not quite clear about this, terms perhaps to be tied to that of the House of Representatives. This combination of features, of course, is only to be found in the Victorian model. So it seems to be having some influence. Another less significant change occurred to the WA Legislative Council in 2005. The 6 districts which had previously elected 5 or 7 members were reconfigured to elect 6 members each. This change was introduced against the background of the attempted removal of zoning or structural malapportionment from the WA electoral system, an attempt which was successful in the case of the lower house, but which was unacceptable to a majority of the upper house. The key players at this time in the upper house were the Greens, and they decided that the Senate model, with its federally based structural malapportionment, could be applied to WA. So we ended up with something that looks like, you know, the Senate at half Senate election time. We've got 6 member contests for the upper house across WA. And I've argued, Campbell's argued in articles, might come back to this, 6 members, even numbers with low district magnitudes is not a very good idea. So the undesirable 6 member district was adopted for WA, the WA upper house, and the metropolitan and non-metropolitan zones, that is structural malapportionment, was retained. Now, I worry about this. I think over time, the retention of malapportionment for the upper house may well weaken the legitimacy of WA's upper house because, firstly, the Senate analogy, in my view, is defective, and secondly, unlike the situation in the past, gross malapportionment in the Legislative Council continues alongside a very equally apportioned lower house. When they were both malapportioned, the legitimacy of the upper house wasn't affected. Okay, a range of issues. Seems to me that there are two important issues related to innovations in institutional design, or two underlying issues. And these are, firstly, the high-profile one of how innovations have affected the ability of upper houses to check lower house majorities or executives. So to what extent have innovations affected the ability of upper houses to check lower houses and their majorities? The second issue is a lower profile one, but just as important, I think. And here the question is how innovations have affected the roles and role perceptions of members of upper houses. Or in other words, how innovations have affected the sort of check, the character of the check that the upper house provides. And this issue is closely related to that of the quality of members of upper houses, I think. So let's look at the first one first, very quickly. This is the high-profile issue of how innovations have affected the ability of upper houses to check lower houses. And here there are two issues. The first set of design innovations which is relevant here is those innovations which have affected partisan balance. Those innovations that have affected partisan balance in the upper house. The second sort of design innovation that's important here is those affecting constitutional powers. So let's look first at partisan balance. In the mainland states which have adopted PR for their upper houses, the most critical elements are in producing an upper house which doesn't replicate the partisan balance in the lower house. And that's critical for the ability of an upper house to check a lower house, that neither of the major blocks, major competitors for government, can have a majority in the upper house. And the critical factors determining partisan balance in the upper house are district magnitude and rotation of upper house members. Both of these mechanisms have important effects on the potential for incongruence, that is, for the balance to be different, partisan balance to be different in the upper house than in the lower house. In terms of design, a trade-off seems to exist between these two elements. So if you go for a high district magnitude, rotation becomes less important. If you go for a low district magnitude, you probably want to think seriously before you jettison rotation. And of course, the Victorians have introduced an electoral system with the lowest district magnitude in Australia, 5 members. Now, I think that'll generally produce upper houses where neither major party has a majority, but there's a risk there. And the risk is greater when you don't have rotation of upper house members. For the same reason, where constituency magnitudes are reasonably low, I think even numbers, as in WA, should be avoided. So I think WA and Victoria, sure, they've innovated, but these are not innovations that I'd be recommending other people follow overly. So they've combined low district magnitudes with elimination of rotation. I think that's risky. Secondly, about the ability of upper houses to check lower houses, constitutional powers, the developments here of interest are Victorian ones. Firstly, the reduction of the Legislative Council's power over bills appropriating monies for the ordinary annual services of government. This power has been reduced to that of a suspensory veto or power of delay of 1 month. I don't want to discuss this further, except to say that it was a classic case of a sledgehammer to crack a nut. In my view, it has unnecessarily and unwisely demolished a useful check on executive government, albeit of a reserve kind, and a means of generating appropriate parliamentary debate over parliamentary matters. The other set of rules affecting constitutional powers are rules for resolving deadlocks over non-budgetary legislation. The Victorians have introduced a joint sitting, the mechanism of a joint sitting, to deal with deadlocked bills and these are defined now in the Constitution, so that after any election, recourse to a joint sitting is virtually automatic. And these changes, in effect, have reduced the power of the Legislative Council over ordinary legislation to a suspensory veto. Not, I'd argue, qualitatively different from that of the House of Lords. And I think this is also unfortunate. So that's the high-profile issue, the innovations that affect the ability of upper houses to check lower houses. What about my second issue, roles and role perceptions of members of upper houses? I'd argue, and I haven't got time to really develop this, that it would be desirable for the further development of Australian upper houses for members to have two characteristics. Firstly, to be more focused in terms of their role perceptions, to be more focused on the core roles of upper houses and less influenced than they are now by partisan perceptions of their roles. Secondly, I'd argue it would be desirable for upper house members to be guided more by personal judgment and the interests of their constituencies, again, at the expense of party control or partisanship. I read somewhere a report of a statement Barnaby Joyce had made about what his priorities were. And his statement, assuming he actually said this, and I've got no reason to doubt this, his statement about his priorities neatly encapsulates the sort of objective that I have in mind here. Barnaby Joyce said, and I think this was when he turned down the offer of a... of a shadow portfolio. He said, perhaps he wouldn't be terribly reliable in that role. Because his priorities in this order were Queensland, the Senate, the National Party and the Coalition. And at least in this respect, in terms of order of priorities, I'd like to see a lot more senators and members of upper houses have this sort of orientation. Three underappreciated design issues raised by trends in institutional innovation are worthy of note in this context. First is ballot structure, the thing that we fill out when we vote for members of our upper houses. With subtle variations, the mainland states have adopted the Senate arrangements, especially ticket or above-the-line voting. And the result of this is extreme party discipline in the upper house, more extreme, despite what we heard these days, despite what we heard former Senator Boehm say a little while ago, than is the case in the lower house. The role perceptions are more governed by partisanship in the Senate than they are among the major parties than is the case in the lower house. There's research to back that up. Following recent changes, Victoria has lessened slightly the disincentive to vote below the line by requiring voters to preference only as many candidates as there are seats to fill in the district, that is five candidates. But I'd argue there's a case for going much further than this and adopting the entire Hare-Clark package. So there'll be no above-the-line voting in this sort of arrangement, no above-the-line voting. Optional preferences only up to, like Victoria, up to the number of seats to be filled. Robson rotation, so the parties can't list their people in a party preferred order. That rotates across the balance, and no how-to-vote card. So party names would be on the ballot, and then it would be up to the electors to choose. They want to vote Labor, which one do they want to put first, second, whatever. And they'd only need to mark a limited number of boxes on the Hare-Clark model. So ballot structure, I think, is critical to structuring the roles and role perceptions of members of upper house. Secondly, term length. The shorter the term, the less the incentive for independent-mindedness in members of upper houses. I searched the other day for press reports on Senator Faulkner's recent statements, and the one I found had him expressing as a primary concern the incentive long term's created for senators to abandon their parties. And I thought, well, something that you know, if I could think of something that was least harmful to the functioning of the Senate, it would be the incentive that long terms create for senators to leave their parties and show some large measure of independence. I've got some sympathy, however, with the argument that similar term lengths for both houses might be desirable on democratic grounds, but the matter shouldn't be looked at in isolation, and compensation for the effect on incentives or reduction in term length would be essential. WA and Victoria, which have similar term lengths, maximum term lengths for both houses, I think are not especially good models in this regard. Thirdly and finally, there's the question of conjoint elections for the two houses. Simply assumed these days, at least in mainland Australia, that elections for both houses will occur on the same day and that this is obviously desirable. But this was not always the case. The original model of Australian bicameralism, as applied in all states with elective bicameralism, incorporated temporal separation of upper and lower house elections. This tradition continues, of course, in Tasmania, which also exemplifies the link between complex or elaborate rotation and non-conjoint elections, which was a feature of elective bicameralism across all of the states in the past. People look at me very strangely when I suggest that reviving separate upper and lower house elections might be desirable in Australia. But aside from the case of Tasmania, some support can be derived from the US model. Admittedly, elections for the US Senate and House of Representatives are held concurrently. But importantly, in the United States, elections for the legislature and the executive are partly separated. While this is not a requirement for a formal separation of executive and legislative power, it does assist in sustaining a sense of differentiated governmental institutions. The problem with mainland Australian practice is that every upper house election occurs in conjunction not only with a lower house election, but also, and most importantly, with a de facto contest for government. And it's the latter contest, that for government, which dominates everything else. And I think this is particularly harmful to upper houses, whose identity, unlike that of lower houses, is not inevitably and not desirably bound up with the formation of and competition for government. Separate election cycles would assist in focusing everyone's attention on the distinctive mission of upper houses. In conjunction with the other institutional innovations I've suggested, this would, I'd argue, help refocus members of upper houses, as well as those selecting and electing them, on the core functions of an upper house. Looking at my watch, I see I've probably gone over time. I apologise for that. Hopefully we'll still have heaps of time. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, Bruce, I'm looking a little alarmed. Hare Clark. Separate elections, my God, struggling to understand the system we have for elections, never mind going to Hare Clark. What I did was, when I read what the topic was, innovations, is we sat down and sort of thought about what are we doing that's innovative in New South Wales, and sort of came up with a couple of things which I think have been innovative and have enhanced the role of the House in holding the executive to account. One of them is an innovation that was practised very commonly during the 19th century but fell into abeyance during the 20th. First of all, as I should point out, the New South Wales Legislative Council is the oldest parliament in this country, and as such it's got quite a colourful history. It's a continuous house, although people argue about whether it's the same house because it's gone from being an appointed advisory council to the governor to now a house which the government would like to get rid of. And I will give some credit to the former leader of my house, who was the treasurer, and I'm not talking Michael Costa, Michael Egan used to go around the countryside attending conferences talking about why we should be abolishing the upper house. But despite his public front, he funded us, which was marvellous, and it allowed us to develop a committee system. We're not getting the same sympathy these days, although the government's not talking about abolishing us. I think they found another way around that. What had happened was we stopped using... The other innovation I want to talk about is the self-reference powers, which our general purpose committees have been using. Talk about some of the pros and cons of those and just briefly a couple of examples of how that works. And then I was going to conclude talking about an electoral change that occurred in 1999, which I think is actually a threat to the operation of the House and to its role as a House of Review. If there's some time at the end, I would like to make some general observations, but I'll see how we go. So the orders for papers was apparently quite common up until probably around the 1920s, where that's where the House passes a motion ordering the executive of the day to hand over papers about what it's up to. It was not used then for about approximately 80 years. It wasn't used. It then came back into favour. The Labor Party in opposition in the early 90s found it a very useful tool in the lower house, where they had that three-year period where the lower house was not government-controlled. And so they very effectively used the power of the opposition to demand the government table documents to find out everything that the government was doing and then use that against them. So they then won government in 1995. Of course, the now opposition thought, great, we've lost control in the lower house, but we've now got control to some extent in the upper house. So they started putting motions on the paper and passing resolutions demanding that the government table documents. And it was at that point that the government came up with a rather novel interpretation that said that only the lower house has the right to demand the executive to table documents. The upper house doesn't have that power. So probably all of you are familiar with the court cases. There were three court cases that were contested in our house where Egan did challenges because he truly didn't believe we had the power to do it. And they had advice, as somebody was talking about earlier, from the Crown Solicitor and the Solicitor General, which backed up their position that the upper house did not have this power to do what they were proposing to do. So we went to the Supreme Court and then eventually to the High Court to challenge that. We won both. They then came up with another interpretation which said that we can't demand privileged documents and we had to go back to court. They didn't take that one to the High Court, but they lost all three cases. And they're interesting reading for people who are interested in politics, some of the arguments. What we particularly enjoyed doing was using the Attorney General's advice to the government when he was not a Member of Parliament. QC, he had provided advice to the Labor opposition about the power to order documents, and we were able to use his advice then against the government and when they were in power. So it was a rather novel way to see him then saying, well, that's not quite what I meant when I gave that advice. But anyway, the really good thing that came out of that, though, is that there's a genuine recognition now in New South Wales that the Crown Solicitor gives advice to the government that the government wants, whereas up until this time, if the Crown Sol said, no, you can't do it, nobody would question it, neither the government nor the opposition. If the Crown Sol said, that's the way it is, then that's the way it was. So at least since the Egan cases, we now have recognition that it is simply advice given to the government by the government's advisers, and we frequently go out and get contrary advice. So that's the history behind it. One of the innovative things we came up with was neither party wanted to actually, neither of the major parties, wanted to call for certain documents. They didn't want to undermine the fabric of government being able to operate with some sort of confidentiality. So we put into our order a provision which allowed for the government to claim privilege over documents. So that we still demanded that the documents be tabled because the House had the right to demand those documents. But what we did was we gave this proviso that said the government may claim privilege over documents. They're supposed to give reasons why they're claiming privilege, and then those documents are made available only to members of the House. So that's what we're currently doing, and we get quite a lot of claims of privilege. But over the period of time, what we found is a growing reluctance on the part of the government to call any papers non-privileged. So I'll just give you a quick rundown of how this has basically worked. We've had quite a few orders for papers over the since the cases came down, since 1999. There is a diminution of them at the moment, which I'll get to later in the paper. We're not having as many orders for papers. And there has been a growing claim of privilege over the documents and almost a reluctance on the part of the opposition and crossbenchers now to dispute claims of privilege. Not quite sure if I know why that's the case. But there have been some unusual precedents in relation to these arbiters' reports. First of all, in May 2003, there was a return to order relating to the Millennium trains, in which the House received over 130 boxes of documents. Of these, privilege was claimed over more than 100 boxes. Given this sizeable claim, the House decided that this wasn't an acceptable situation. So basically it passed a motion which required the departments and authorities to reassess their claim of privilege on the documents and within 14 days to provide a list of those documents which should not be released for publication and their reasons in support of the claim of privilege. The Premier's department subsequently did provide a new return to order with a separate claim of privilege on a lot lower number of documents. Another interesting example of the process in operation was in June 2004, in compliance with an order of the House from the 1st of June, three boxes of privileged documents were tabled with the clerk in relation to the M5 tunnel ventilation system. These were disputed. Any member, by the way, can dispute a claim of privilege. All they have to do is write to the clerk and say, I dispute the claim of privilege. Then the clerk's authorised to release this to an independent arbiter. And this independent arbiter has to be either a retired Supreme Court judge or a QC or an SC. Has to be somebody who is of some legal standing. We have predominantly been using Sir Lawrence Street, although recently we've been broadening the field a little bit more. And I must say it can become quite interesting as a clerk deciding which arbiter you should be sending things to and who's in favour. So the papers were provided to Sir Lawrence Street for assessment and report. However, due to logistical difficulties, for example, the sheets weren't stapled together, others were unidentifiable, the names and capacity of the author were matters of inference, the papers weren't paginated, and just the sheer volume of some of the bundles meant that Sir Lawrence reached the conclusion that the task was impossible to determine the claim of privilege over them. And it's quite costly, by the way. We don't get funded for this. There is no regulation of it, and it's entirely up to the arbiter how long they take to go through these things to give them back to us. That's one of the reasons that we're very careful about who we use and how much it will cost. And the more experience that Sir Lawrence gets, the easier it is for us because he can do it quite quickly now. Anyway, the arbiter contacted us and basically said he couldn't do it. It was too hard. So what he did then with our authority was ring up the department and say, if you don't fix this, I'm going to make them all public. Because he perceived that it was actually an attempt by the department to obfuscate by simply making it almost impossible to find anything. It would have taken them months to go through, try and sort out what was what and to link it. And, of course, in response to that, the Roads and Traffic Authority and its solicitors did rebundle them and index them and put them into some sort of order so that the arbiter was able to go through with them. And that did help a little bit from then on because it showed that the arbiter wasn't prepared to go along with the scheme of let's make this so impossible that they can't work it out. There was another interesting example in 2005 where the House ordered a reassessment of a previous return to order in relation to the Cross City Tunnel. Originally, Sir Lawrence had upheld the claim of privilege and hadn't released the documents. However, in October 2005, when the matter had become such a difficult issue in the state, there was such public outcry against it that there was a reassessment of it, and the documents were sent off to him for a reassessment as to whether the claim of privilege should still be upheld. And basically he came back and released a lot of these documents, saying that in view of the fact that the tunnel had been completed, in view of the high level of public concern, public interest in disclosure of the documents, that he thought that the continued non-disclosure had potential to diminish public confidence in the Roads and Traffic Authority's handling of the project and in the RTA itself. So, accordingly, he recommended that these documents be made public, and they subsequently were. Something interesting that's come out from the arbiter's reports, and it's something we want to do some work on in the not-too-distant future, Sir Lawrence has actually made some really interesting comments in his arbiter's reports that are now public. The one in relation to the Iron Cove Bridge at Drummoyne, he actually said that was this year. Now, I'm going to quote you the bit that he said, because I think it's an interesting reflection on how governments are responding and how people working for governments respond. It says, "When dealing with matters of this nature, I'm frequently troubled by the impression that, in segregating documents with reference to a possible claim of privilege, the question addressed by the responsible officer is, can privilege be claimed for this document? If the answer is yes, then the claim's made. I would believe it would promote public confidence in the discharge by public authorities of their responsibilities if, where this question is answered yes, a further question were posed. Do we need to make the claim of privilege? In a great many matters ranging across a variety of topics that have been referred to me as the arbiter, substantial numbers of documents justify the answer yes to the first of the two questions I have posed and are made the subject of a claim of privilege without the second question being addressed. I do not by any means intend to convey a universal criticism, as in a great many cases it is possible to perceive the need for the claim of privilege. But in an appreciable number of other instances, there's no apparent need, for example, inconsequential emails passing between persons in the public sector. Privilege ought not to be claimed for them simply on the basis of technical grounds for privilege." There's another side effect which I haven't really gone into here, which is the one where there's this sort of growing attempt by the government to claim privilege cabinet confidentiality on documents. I haven't addressed that in this paper, but a lot of documents at the moment are being called cabinet documents by virtue of the fact that they are appended to a cabinet minute, or as one magistrate in New South Wales said, they're put in a wheelbarrow and walk through the corridor of cabinet, and after that they become cabinet in confidence. As I said, neither of the major parties in New South Wales want to have cabinet documents released. So if you can get something made part of a cabinet document, then you don't have to produce it to the House. And so that's something which we may need to address in the future, of what exactly is a cabinet document. Anyway, to date, the House has always accepted the recommendations of the independent legal arbiter as whether there is a claim of privilege. And the House has agreed when the arbiter has come back and the report's been tabled, and the House has agreed to the documents being released. I mean, it has no choice, but they have allowed the motions through and they haven't tried to manoeuvre the numbers to stop it. However, recently, well, since 2007, there have been not only fewer orders for papers, but these days the motions going onto the paper, and the government, with the collusion of some of the crossbenchers, is able to say, we're not going to push that through. I mean, in the past, these reports were made public under formal business. There was no debate. The government just said, yeah, no objection, let it go through. These days, they're objecting to every one of them, and they're not being brought on, and the numbers aren't there for them. So I'm a little alarmed at the way that process is going. But hopefully I'm going to get time just to talk about the election, because I think that is part of what's happened. GPS is very quickly... basically, approximately half of all our GPS inquiries are general purpose standing committees have self-referenced references before them. We've copied this system largely from the Senate, and it's worked really well. We have a standing committee system which is government-controlled, government-chaired, and is largely used for the long, detailed inquiries. There's usually unanimous reports or only minor dissension on those committees, and these are used often by the government to have difficult inquiries into matters of great concern, and the reports come down and are largely consensual. The GPSs, on the other hand, are highly political. They haven't been government controlled. They are not meant to have government control on them in terms of the membership, although at the moment we do have one government chair of one of those committees, and with one of the other ones it is chaired by a member who has now received a position as assistant, a newly created position of assistant deputy president, and subsequently does a lot more voting with the government by virtue of that office, I think. So apart from that, we've had about half of the references are self-referred. And the reason that I think is important is that it allows them flexibility to initiate inquiries when the House isn't sitting. And indeed, there have been inquiries that have been initiated, conducted and completed during recess of the House. So, I mean, in that regard, it is a very good method of being able to continue to operate when the House isn't in session. And there have been some undoubtedly very effective GPS inquiries that have been self-referred to the committees. Just a couple of examples of that. We've got recent one, which I think is actually still ongoing, is the one into the New South Wales Ambulance Service. You've probably seen reports in the paper about the suicides and the difficulties that have gone on with the ambulance service in New South Wales. And just during the course of the inquiry, the government, prompted by the inquiry, has moved to address some of the issues. So, I mean, I think that's an example of a self-reference that's working fairly effectively. Back in 2001, there was another very effective one where one of our GPSs looked into Cabramatta policing, and the government took on board most of the recommendations of that committee, even though it was a hostile committee and quite a difficult time that we went through. But there have also been some highly political inquiries conducted by the GPSs under their self-referral, where it's been the numbers on the committee that have referred them, and they've been largely done for political reasons rather than necessarily wanting to have a full and frank inquiry. I think a good example of that is the Orange Grove inquiry. It's known as the inquiry into the Designer Outlet Centre, and one of the reasons that we're very critical of this is that during the process of this inquiry, the committee actually pressed the bounds, I think, of what should be due committee process and procedural fairness to witnesses before this committee, and it was a very unpleasant inquiry to be involved with. So, I mean, there are pros and cons, I think, for this self-referring power. It can also be overused. For example, a former chair during the 52nd Parliament, he's no longer a member, but at one stage he had five different inquiries on the books of a small committee with limited resources, and the inquiries just couldn't get done appropriately. Okay, I'm running out of time. So what I'll do is very quickly I'd like to just talk then about the changes to the electoral system, which I think are impacting on the way that the House operates. As was mentioned earlier, when proportional representation was introduced in 1978 into the House, we had optional preferential voting. Quota to get elected to the upper house was about 6.25%. In 1987, we introduced the group voting ticket, or above-the-line voting. In 1991, the membership in the House was reduced to 42 members, down from 45. The terms of the members were reduced to two terms of the Legislative Assembly, so that's 8 years. We now have fixed-term parliaments, and the quota to get elected to the upper house is about 4.55%. Some things happened in the 90s. 1995, we had a member elected to the upper house. His name was Alan Corbett. He represented the Better Future for Our Children party. He was basically a protest party. He spent about $500 on his campaign. He simply got a few of his friends to sign up to the party, got the party registered, and simply put a protest vote onto the paper, called his party the Better Future for Our Children as a statement of the fact that he thought that our political parties were not paying attention to our children. Well, people voted for him. He got preferences. Parties, without really knowing what he stood for, votes were given to his party, and he managed to get elected. He got 1.28% of the first preference votes, and he was elected basically on the flow of preferences. That seemed like such a good idea that in 1999 we ended up with what's become known as the tablecloth ballot paper. At that election we had 264 candidates on our paper representing 80 parties. The ballot paper measured 1 metre by 70 centimetres. It was enormous, and for those of you coming from New South Wales, it brought logistical nightmares in. They had to bring in bigger ballot boxes, and they had to bring in larger voting booths. They had to get cranes to move the papers. And at the end of the day, it brought our house into disrepute, because the outcome was that three candidates were elected with less than 1% of first preference votes, or about 0.04 of a quota. One candidate managed to get 1.5 quotas, but didn't get a second seat in the House, or one party, sorry, the One Nation got it, because there were no preferences went. So although they had 1.5 quotas, they only got one candidate, whereas somebody with 0.04 of a quota got a candidate. And basically it was a manipulation of preference flows, especially from micro and front parties. We ended up with 13 crossbench members in a House of 42. Now, I can sort of go through the pros and cons, but because I've been given my warning, I really can't. The real difficulty, though, was that both major parties in our House, together with the Greens, decided something needed to be done. We couldn't have this. It was a manipulation of the system. You had front parties that were on that paper. You had people saying they were representing women who weren't representing women. You had people who said they were greenies when they were really, what they meant was we should be opening up our national parks to allow four-wheel drive vehicles in, etc., etc. And it was literally trying to get people to vote for them, split the vote, and then you get this complicated process of sharing the votes. And it really affected the major parties. So what happened in 1999 was we brought in the Parliamentary Elections and Electorates Amendment Bill. I'd just very quickly like to finish this. Just what it did was it tightened the rules for registration of political parties. You now need 750 members for registration, up from 200. You need $2,000 application fee for registration, and you've got to pay $5,000 to contest an election. You also have to be registered 12 months before an election, so you can't get a good idea prior to the election and just put yourself up. You've got to get in there 12 months in advance. And I think that's had a major impact on minor and micro parties, because it's harder for them to get elected. So they're not putting up the money, which they're then going to lose. There's no preference deals. But perhaps the most significant thing, I think, is that they took away this the group voting ticket, and unlike Bruce Stone, I actually think that in some respects it was good to have above the line. I think it is good to have it. But what we're doing now is you have to actually put your preferences there. Otherwise you don't get a preference. So if you put only a one in a minor party category where that vote's exhausted, your vote then just is exhausted. It doesn't get distributed in any way to anybody else. And it's had a significant impact on our House. Down from 13 crossbench members, we're down to 8. The Greens certainly benefited. They now have 4 members out of the 8 crossbench members. But just as some sort of indication of what the outcome of that now is, that it's not only reduced the impact and effect of the crossbench members, the government's increased the numbers in the House. It now only needs 3 out of the 8 crossbench members. Our crossbench consists of basically 4 Greens and 4 Conservative. The Conservative consists of 2 Christian Democratic Party and 2 Shooters, and they form largely a voting bloc, although once again the Christian Democratic Party has split. It's not the first time they've done that, but occasionally you will see a split in those two. They vote different ways, but the Shooters always vote the same way. So the government's able to get its legislation through much more readily. It's able to get its resolution to pass just because it can either... its reforming agenda gets supported by the Greens, its Conservative agenda gets supported by the Conservatives. And so I think it's just to finish off, basically, in 2006, there were 203 amendments to bills, 94 were agreed, which was basically 46%. In 2007, after the election, there were 344 amendments in a shortened session, only 38 were agreed, which was down to 11%. And as a sizeable mention to what's happened to the Greens, of their 242 amendments that they moved last year, and early this year, only 8 have been agreed to, and it has been remarked upon so much so that when they got their first amendments through, there was a overall applause and cheering broke out in the House. And this is for a party which, prior to the last election, had a significant number of amendments going through and was having a major impact on the legislation in the House. So I'll just finish on that.
Ladies and gentlemen, I recall that the last time I was in this building talking about Victorian bicameralism, I was the bearer of mildly optimistic tidings. 5 years later, it has to be said that that optimism, even though it was mild, seems somewhat misplaced. What the purpose of my short paper is to look at do an audit, if you like, on the Constitution Parliamentary Reform Bill 2003, which introduced the changes that Bruce spoke about and which, of course, came into full effect with the declaration of the poll of the 2006 election. Now, in terms of optimism and pessimism, the result of the election was on the optimistic side, that is, no big party has a majority in its own right in the upper house. The Labor Party won 19 regions, the Liberal Party won 15, the Greens won 3, the National Party won 2, and the DLP won 1. So we went from a situation where previously that chamber had 3 parties, it now had 5. But it was a close-run thing. The count was prolonged, as I guess was to be expected at the first time they had a PR election. At a number of times during that count, it was quite plausible that the Labor Party was going to win 21 of the regions and therefore have a majority. The fact that that didn't happen really came down to quite small numbers of votes determining who was getting eliminated and who was benefiting from the cascading of preferences and who wasn't. So in 2 regions, Northern and Western, Labor almost won those places. They didn't, but they almost won them. I think in the future, the possibility of a majority of one way or the other in the upper house is quite strong. If Labor had done as well at the 2006 election as it did in 2002, it would definitely have had a majority. So, I mean, this was not rocket science at the time. As Bruce pointed out, very low district magnitude in Victoria means very high quota, means the possibility of having clear majorities in the upper house. But that has not happened. Where it all becomes problematic, of course, is whether or not this has actually had the effect of, to quote the Constitutional Commission Victoria, which was the body charged with advising on all this, whether the recommendations that it made have really enabled, to quote them, the Legislative Council to operate effectively as a genuine house of review. Now, rather than look at the legislative contest, of which there hasn't been a great deal, largely because, as you can see, the ideological makeup of that upper house, at least until the Liberals and Nationals went back into coalition, was quite diverse. So, again, on what you might call progressive issues, the government could rely on the Greens. On less progressive issues, they could probably rely on the Liberal Party. So there hasn't been a great deal of full-on legislative conflict. What I wanted to look at were committees where there has been more action. Not all of it positive, but there has been action. Now, I guess many people know that the Victorian Parliament has a long history of committees. But until recently, its committees, in addition to what we know as the domestic committees of privileges and whatever, most of the committees in the Victorian Parliament are joint select committees largely dealing with policy issues, road safety, regional development and so on. Now, there are 2, the Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee and the Public Accounts and Estimates Committee, which have the capacity to discharge what we would recognises accountability or scrutiny functions. But again, of course, they have majorities and they have government chairs. There's only one committee of the joint type that doesn't have a government chair. And interestingly, that was given to a National Party MP before the coalition was reformed. I don't think that would have happened had there been a coalition at the time. As people, I guess, know that both houses have the capacity to set up ad hoc select committees to investigate pretty well anything it wants. The history of select committees has been patchy. There were no select committees during the period 1992-99, where the government had a majority in both houses. There were two in the period 99 to 2002, when the government didn't have a majority. There were none between 2002 and 2006, when the government did have a majority. And now we've had it's the standard practice, I suppose. The question then all came up as to what is going to go on with committees. Would the Legislative Council develop a distinctive scrutiny set of committees? Well, it's moved somewhat in the direction, but only very moderately. There is an institutional problem. When you remove ministers, parliamentary secretaries, presiding officers and whatever out of the chamber, there's only 29 people available to serve on committees. Now, a lot of them don't want to give up the opportunity to serve on joint select committees for various reasons. One of the problems we had with all this is if you go back and have a look at the Constitutional Commission's report, and it never came out in favour of one particular model of PR, it canvassed, I think, five or six. But it was quite obvious that it was pushing in the direction of a 7x7 composition. But unfortunately, or deliberately, the government had preempted all that before the process had started, had said, we're going to reduce the size of the Legislative Council, which had two deleterious effects: high quota, fewer members available to serve. OK, I'm going to break the rest of the paper into a very quick account of what's happened in committees, not going into the substance of what the committees were inquiring into, and then try to draw out a series of themes that seem to have emerged from what has gone on. OK, the two committees that were set up in the 99 to 2002, one looked at the granting of a tender by a local council, and the other one looked at the employment of a person to a senior job in the public service. Both were carried out in the atmosphere of somebody had committed sin or error and this needed to be corrected. One thing that it did do, I think, is that it gave the government a bit of a shock because the appointment of the person to the senior public sector position, who had been a long-term friend of the then Premier, had, I think, a corrective effect in the sense that the publicity that came about all that is that the person resigned from the position before they even took it up, which I think has made the government a little more cautious about how it goes about appointing people. Then before the election of 2006, we had a trial of a council-only legislation committee, that's what it was called, and it conducted public inquiries into two bills that were referred to it. Now, this committee has been reconstituted as permanent into the sense of the life of this parliament. Without going into the details, though, it hasn't done much work because there's a lot of confusion, and I think it is genuine confusion and reticence on the part of members of the council rather than the government about what is the real purpose of this committee. So since it's been reconstituted, it has brought down two very brief reports on two very non-controversial bills. So I suspect it will not be reconstituted in the next parliament, and I don't think that's a bad thing, because it seems to have been set up very rapidly without a lot of thought. It overlaps some of the functions of the Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee, and as I'll say later, another committee has been set up. In February 2007, the Council set up a select committee to probe allegations that the Premier had provided a lobbyist with information that might have affected gaming licences. Now, you can imagine the atmosphere in which that was conducted. Another one was set up in May 2007 to investigate the sale of public land amidst allegations that developers were paying money into party funds and getting preference in purchasing public land. Neither came to any firm conclusion, but the reason for that will come out later. One piece of perhaps going back to my mild optimism, in November of last year, the council set up a Finance and Public Administration Committee, pretty much on the lines of the one in the Senate here. Now, it has conducted but one inquiry, and it's a bit hard to tell how well it's going to work because it was an inquiry into an issue in which the two big parties were basically at one, so there wasn't any heat in it, so it's a bit hard to tell. But if there's any grounds for optimism, it's in there. And as I said, we haven't got enough evidence yet to judge that. OK, themes. All right, there's been a high degree of partisanship evident everywhere. The select committees are characterised by multiple vote divisions, which always come out 3-2, a bit like the American Supreme Court in a similar way. There are minority reports all the time. There are government members, not necessarily cabinet ministers, but government members in the upper house as well, have denounced the select committees as witch hunts. The government has refused leave to assembly ministers to appear before upper house committees and extended it, as will come as no great surprise to you, to ministerial advisers. Also, the executive has asserted a very broad scope of executive privilege, or as it's, I think this is a somewhat sanitised description of it, as public interest immunity. I think executive privilege is probably worth retaining.